It's Wednesday, August 21st, 2019, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, the New York Times Magazine's special edition, the entire country is talking about the 1619 Project. We're going to talk about it and the way that it has reframed American history around the arrival of the first slave ship on North American shores. The road to redemption after sexual harassment allegations, it can be a bumpy one, as Mark Halperin found out this week. We're going to talk about his new book deal and why it's causing problems for him and a host of other Democrats. And a New Orleans television reporter's death in a plane crash raises questions about when and how it's worth taking risks to get the story. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well. But first, we've got a new face and a new voice at the table with us today. Kathy Kiley joins Ernest and me as the new third voice of Views of the News. Kathy, I'd like to welcome you with that. A present for you, your very own Views of the News coffee mug.
The legendary Views of the News coffee mug. I mean, what more could I want?
They're very special to the two of us.
Yes.
You are relatively new to Mid-Missouri, joining us here at the School of Journalism about a year ago, but you are not new to reporting, to media, and to looking very critically at what goes on in that landscape.
No, and I know I have big shoes to fill here. The fabulous Mike McKean, we're all going to miss him, but I'm really honored to be at this table. I've been a reporter and an editor for many, many years and have seen a lot of changes. So I think what I like to tell my students here at the Missouri School of Journalism is I'm qualified to teach you because I've made a lot of mistakes that you can learn from. So I hope to bring that experience to our discussions.
Well, as have we too, and we learn from those and have the opportunity to discuss them. We talk about mistakes, and we're going to talk about one that has gone back a couple of years and is kind of coming back to the forefront and new mistakes being made with it as well. Mark Halperin, a political pundit who spent many years at ABC News, also did some work for CNN, for HBO, and accused in a sexual harassment, series of sexual harassment incidents a few years back, in which those networks cut ties with him. His name back in the news and media circles this week because he has a new book deal, and not only does he have a book deal, but there have been some pretty big names on the left who talked to him about it.
Yes, one of the places Mark worked that you didn't mention is Bloomberg, and I worked with him at Bloomberg. So I think this is really much more than a mistake. This is really a pattern of behavior, and I think when Mark's when what he did was first surfaced by a number of women, he was very quickly removed from the roles of a number of organizations he worked for. And I think that there was a reason it was so quick. I actually wrote a column about this for USA Today at the time, and I really think that it's an example of what I might call anchorman syndrome, and I don't mean that to disparage anchor people who are quite important, but and many of them are quite nice people, but the idea that you can be a diva and that you can abuse other people. And
the superstar system.
Yes, exactly. And what was certainly known at Bloomberg about Mark, I don't think any of us knew about the allegations that eventually surfaced, but what we did know was that he was a bully and he was abusive of other people and he was allowed to be that way. And I think in too many places of employment, there's a different rule of gravity for certain people. They fall up. And I think this is another example of it. And I think that's why people are so infuriated. Why is it that an offense, which he really hasn't fully apologized for, many of the victims have not been contacted by him. Why is he able to write a book and get a book contract when for other people that would be a complete disqualifier?
You know, what I find strange about this is the people who he actually interviewed for this book, David Axelrod, Donna Brazile. These are big names in Democratic political circles. I mean, the book is the book is going to be about the upcoming election and what is it going to take to beat for the Democrats to beat Donald Trump. Many of them are now sort of backtracking saying, well, maybe I should not have interviewed with him, or let me explain why I thought it was important that I interview. And it's more about the subject of the book as opposed to the person that's writing it. But it's very hard to divorce yourself from someone who is been whose career or end of career has been shaped by the Me Too movement. And that's, I think, where this is very problematic for the publisher and anyone else involved.
And I also think this is one reason, this kind of sums up why I left Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. because there's too much of this that goes on. It's the buddy-buddy system. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. And Mark was a big name. I understand why people would feel sorry for him. It's sad to see somebody blow up their career. But really, this is everything that the Democratic candidates say they're against. They say they want to stand up for women. They say that their party represents something different than Donald Trump's party or Donald Trump's behavior. Mm-hmm. And this is sure giving aid and comfort to somebody who doesn't fit that program.
So let me ask both of you this, and I know we've talked about it in the past, as other men involved in the Me Too scandal have attempted to make that road to recovery, attempted to put pieces of shattered careers back together. Is there a road back? This Mark Halperin book deal is kind of the furthest we've seen anybody go. We've kind of had those conversations about Charlie Rose. Could he make a television comeback? What's next for Matt Lauer? This is the first one where we're actually seeing an exchange of money and forward motion.
I think and look what's happened. I mean, it's sort of blown up, not only on him, but also on the publisher. I think it's too soon for that. And I think to be able to have that sort of redemption is going to be difficult in light of the current environment. I mean, you still have the president and others out there doing things that would be considered outrageous. And so it's going to be difficult for someone who's caught up into this to say, okay, I'm back. Please open your arms and accept me.
Well, and the other problem is these are people who are trying to come back. It's not somebody who's trying to work their way back from a wrong in a humble way. Mm-hmm. This is like, oh, okay, I'm back. Let me get a big fat book contract. That's not the kind of thing when somebody's done something wrong. You generally don't get that kind of reward. So I think this kind of, you know, I hate to sound like a politician, but I think this really summarizes the ick factor with the insider culture that, oh, it's okay, you're one of us and we're going to take you back in. And that's just what infuriates members of the public, and rightly so, about our political institutional culture.
So here's another one of those ick factor, but it's ick in a different way. I want to bring up a story to both of you that, Kathy, you pointed out actually has a tangential connection here to the Halperin story. Bernie Sanders' campaign sent out an email inviting members of the media to take on Bernie and his staffers in a game of softball at Iowa's iconic Field of Dreams. People who ponied up a donation would walk away with a limited edition Bernie Sanders baseball card. Rookie card or not, being involved in this fundraiser can create some real problems for journalists.
Yes, and what's happened here, and what's unclear to me from the stories, is whether the journalists had a prior understanding of this, but and they've pulled out with good reason, because
most of the national media has. Some of the local Iowa folks remained and stayed in the game.
Well, and that's unfortunate, because essentially what they're doing is they're allowing themselves to be used as a prop for a fundraiser. And this same thing happened when I was working at Bloomberg, and Mitt Romney had a big soiree for all of the, it was a weekend at one of his many homes, for all of the Republican candidates in the 2012 campaign, or 2016 campaign, excuse me. And we found out that Mark was leading an aerobics class for fat cats with Ann Romney. And
fat,
you know,
cats is in the donors. We're not saying they were overweight.
Well, you know.
They may have been. Okay. They were exercising. Yeah, yes. They were doing the right thing.
They were doing the right thing. Yeah. But and, you know, again, this may be innocent, but you're featured as an attraction at a fundraiser, a political fundraiser. That's not something journalists should be involved in.
I mean, you're there to report on what's going on. If you're in Iowa right now with the candidates, you're reporting on how are they responding to issues that are of concern to the people who are going to be voting on them in the caucuses. And that's your role as a journalist. So when something like this comes up, it should be pretty easy to say, I'm good. I can be there to cover it, but I'm not going to be there to participate in it, regardless of whether you're talking about a fundraiser or some sort of a sideshow, whatever you want to call it. You want to make sure that you're there covering it. I mean, even when you're there covering it as a journalist, as many of them are facing in going to Trump rallies, you find yourself being used as a prop when you're there doing your job. So to actually agree to do this makes it even more egregious.
I mean, I could see journalists doing a journalist versus the politician's fundraiser for a good cause, you know, for the American Cancer Society or the Red Cross or something like that. The National Press Club does a fundraiser for their scholarship program, mm-hmm. where journalists and politicians take on each other in a spelling bee. So, but that's raising money for a good cause. Yeah. This is raising money for a political campaign, and it's almost like you're taking sides.
Yeah.
Okay, so there was another situation somewhat like this, maybe, maybe not. We've talked a lot in the past about problematic behaviors from the Sinclair Broadcast Group and what that has looked like. And there was another one of these that came up just this week. One of their television stations produced a story for their website coming out of Albany that featured President Trump's re-election campaign's new hat. And it was a reimagination of the MAGA hat, Make America Great Again for the Re-election, Keep America Great. That story also contained information about where and how to buy it and what the price of it was. One of those Sinclair stations that ran it on its website, there were 20 of them, KRCG here in the Mid-Missouri area.
This is Sinclair taking it another notch. I mean, we talked on this show back, I think it was back in the spring about, Sinclair doing the stories that were
the must runs.
The must run stories. So we talked about that. Here's another, we're definitely supporters of the president, and here's another opportunity to use the station and use our influence, mm-hmm. to show our support for the president. I think this takes it, if not over the line, pretty close to the line of in the old days, violating FCC rules as it relates to being engaged in campaigning for political candidates.
Yeah, if you're a conduit for a candidate's merch. I mean, it's, again, the I think what journalists need to do, we've said this before, and I think it's so important that, and it's something we talk about here a lot in our classes, is that as a journalist, you have such a privilege and such power. And if you can't exercise that in a neutral way, you really don't belong in the journalist corps. If you want to sell a candidate's merch, go work for the campaign. I'm sure they need a good marketing advisor.
Yeah. Okay. We may get back to politics and talk a little bit more about that later, depending on time. But I want to turn our attention to the special edition of the Sunday New York Times Magazine, which first went live online last Wednesday. The entire thing devoted to a single topic, the 1619 Project. 1619 marking the arrival of the first slave ship on the shores of what would become the U.S. 400 years ago. If I were to ask each of you, how would you sum up this project in a tweet? 140 characters or less.
Ooh, that would be difficult.
I know. I was trying to think of a way to do it myself, and that's why I figured I'd put it to you.
And not being a Twitter fan, it's going to make it even harder for me. I think this is I don't want to say a rewrite or a redo, mm-hmm. but a reassessment of the way in which American history is taught, the way in which we talk about the formation of this country and the role that African Americans have played, and you can't have that conversation unless you understand slavery and what it means, what it meant, and what it means to who we are and what we are as Americans.
Well, as a product of Catholic schools, I guess my tweet would be America's Original Sin. Read all about it.
Oh. See, she's better. Yeah. She's much better.
I got more time.
So That's 140 characters or less. Favorite essays. This is ultimately a collection of essays to begin to get to that. Any of them specifically that spoke out to you or that you would point people to directly?
I don't even know where to begin because it deals with...
This is one of those things you could take a day with.
You could take more. A day would not be enough time. It just depends on what your interest is. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're interested in how we got to where we are with healthcare, there's a piece in this project that deals with that. If you're concerned about how we got to where we are with our politics, same thing. I mean, the way in which they crafted this, it points to every major component of who we are and what we are as a country. And it all points back to this date and how this country became what it is today.
I think Ernest's point is really good because this is a story with multiple entry points. Mm-hmm. And it's really not meant to be read in a day or a week, or it's meant to be contemplated. And you can come in at different angles. And I think so it's a great use of innovative digital media because it allows people to get into this story in multiple ways, and they should. And the other thing about this piece that I think is so terrific and interesting is that the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting is producing learning modules to go with that. And so I think this is one of those, sometimes we talk in the business about projects having a long tail, and I think this is one that will, because it's not something that'll be just a story for a day or a week and over. This is something that's an evergreen that anybody interested in American history can go back to again and again, and anybody interested in human nature. The fact that we have within us, that's one of the great mysteries that we try to unpack as journalists, that how can people be so very, very good and very, very bad in one package? And this certainly illustrates that.
From a journalism and a media angle as well, you mentioned the collaboration with the Pulitzer Center and the curriculum development that's been brought about this. There's also collaborations going on with the Smithsonian to be able to incorporate this into the National Museum structure as well. One of the other things that really struck me, though, taking it back just to the New York Times, was the breadth and depth of the collaboration within just the publication. This isn't just a piece that's in the magazine that the magazine owns. There is the launch today of the podcast, The Daily, that the New York Times has, adding to that dialogue and the discussion, that the sports section is taking on certain parts of it as well. This is one of those that really shows a full publication buy-in. It's not just, oh, Special Projects went and did that thing.
You know, I think this is, and we've talked about this on the show many times, is that only a national publication could pull this off. And this demonstrates the stature and the commitment on the part of the New York Times to be a national newspaper. And I know that, you know, there are people in journalism that'll say, well, how could you say that? Because the Washington Post has stature and USA Today may have some stature, but you don't see them pulling this off. Mm-mm. In the way in which they've done it. You were right. I mean, it's not just the magazine, it's the sports section, it's the business section, it's the opinion page, it's the news section. And they've made a commitment for this to be long term. I mean, you're partnering with the Pulitzer Center, you're partnering with the Smithsonian, you're talking about building our curriculum. You're challenging what's written in our history books, because that is what this is doing. It is actually challenging the way in which history is being taught in this country.
Which is interesting, because we talk about that idea of newspapers being the first draft of history. This is a newspaper stepping up to help redraft and rethink history.
Right, exactly.
So this isn't a one-off, it's going to keep going on. What things would you like to be seeing in the coming weeks, months, years? What could you see as next steps that you would want to see this to go even further?
Well, I'm a big fan of the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting, and one of the things they've done with some of their projects, and I don't know if they have it planned for this one, is lecture tours. Mm-hmm. So they will send writers out to college campuses and to public arenas to talk about their work and interact with people. And I think if anything cries out for that sort of thing, it's this piece, because you want people talking about it and talking face-to-face in real life to each other. That's how change gets made. And I just want to add to what Ernest said. This is a news organization, a newspaper, but let's call it news organization
because
it's multimedia, that really made an investment. This is an expensive project. It's labor intensive. It required a lot of salaries of a lot of bright people. And anybody who's ever worked in any kind of a big organization knows how hard it is to get everybody working in the same direction across departments. And this was just a huge commitment. And I just want to give a shout out, because news organizations are so often dragged down, and we're among their first critics. But this is what great journalism is, and it's an important part of our social fabric, and it's why we should work together to keep it going.
I mean, one of the things that I would like to see is how is this actually being utilized? Mm-hmm. How is the public actually engaging in this? I mean, that's sometimes that gets lost in the projects that are done by media organizations. They sort of put it out there, and then they say, okay, well, the public can see it, and they can, but we don't go back to see how are they using it, how are they utilizing it, what kind of difference is this going to make in the way in which people understand and in some ways learn from and appreciate how all this played out.
So as our historian and our scholar, how much time needs to really pass before we can begin to measure that and see what those effects might be?
It's going to take a while because, I mean, this is one of the first big initiatives by a news organization mm-hmm. on the issue of slavery. Mm-hmm. However, over the course of the last 10 to 15 years, there's been a lot of scholarly work on the role that slavery has played in this country that has produced not only Pulitzer Prize winning books, but also National History Award books. I mean, so the scholars, the civil rights scholars have been doing this work for a long time, and now their work is actually reaching out into the general into general history and general population through projects like this.
Okay. Friday afternoon, WVUE TV reporter and anchor Nancy Parker went up with a stunt pilot to produce one of those summertime features. Only there was a problem with the plane's engine, and it crashed, killing both of them. Nancy Parker was a very well-respected journalist in that market, and her loss has been palpable, not only in Louisiana, but across our whole profession. It's raised a lot of questions, though. We talk about journalists putting themselves in harm's way when they're in war zones, when they are covering political unrest, when they're natural disasters, not when we're talking about going to fly. This wasn't the Blue Angels, but the whole, like, I'm going to go up in the Vomit Comet with the Blue Angels.
Well, I think, you know, there's no way that that she could have anticipated that this would have happened. And she probably thought, this is a great feature story. And it's one of those accidents that, you know, you could be taking a bus and something happened. So but what I have always said, all journalism involves some sort of risk. I mean, life involves risks. Mm-hmm. And you really have to calibrate it. There are assignments that I've turned down because I thought, as an American woman in a world where Americans are targeted, that I couldn't go and do my job properly and be safe. And so I've turned down a few assignments for that reason, and I've encouraged my students to do that. So I think every individual has to make these decisions on their own, and most of the time they work out, and sometimes they don't.
I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, if you're a journalist, I mean, you're just in your everyday coverage, you could find yourself in a situation. I mean, if you're a general assignments reporter or if mm-hmm. you're a police reporter and you wind up covering a shooting that's taking place somewhere and you happen to get there before everything is secure, you know, which I found myself in, you're at risk.
Is there more news value, though, in a situation like that than the summertime feature of going out ahead of an air and water show?
Yeah, but you don't know. You don't. She didn't know when she went up in the plane, and neither did the pilot, that there was going to be a problem. I mean, she'd probably done a lot of these kinds of stories before, and then boom, this happens. I mean, you know, traffic reporters go up every day.
Yes.
You know, so.
And we hear about helicopters too. Right. Yeah, it's been a rough couple of weeks at CNN. Contributor April Ryan, well, security guard, kept a Trump-friendly person from being present at one of the speeches she was given. Don Lemon being sued in connection with a harassment incident last year, and by now you've heard about Chris Cuomo's run-in with a man who called him Fredo, referencing the character in The Godfather. CNN's got a bit of an image problem. How do they bounce back from this?
I don't know if it's an image problem.
Okay.
I think it's a problem that's created by the fact that you have the president and others who are calling them enemies of the people, and you know the fake news empire, and these are stars within that CNN orbit who are basically have opened themselves up to these kinds of issues coming up.
So what do they have to do, though, to stay above the fray?
I think try not to get sucked into it. It's very difficult when, you know, this is a real dilemma for journalists.
Yeah.
You know, when the president politicizes your profession and makes you a target. We're really good about saying, on the one hand, on the other hand, but we're not so good about quoting ourselves and saying, the victim said. So I say that to be sympathetic with CNN. I think it's very, very difficult. On the other hand, I sometimes get a sense in CNN's broadcasts that they are enjoying some of the ratings and thinking that they can profit by being the president's target. And I just think, quit being drama queens, do your job. It isn't to say that you're not going to stand up for yourself and defend what we do as journalists, but I don't think you have to get into, and I won't use the newsroom terms, but arguments with the president.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for journalists to try to be as professional as possible in these times. It's hard not to lose your temper sometimes, but if you're getting paid the big bucks and you're a big star, you're representing journalism. So just turn the other cheek and do your job.
Yeah. I think the other thing is that journalists can't go out and speak in public and then tell other journalists that they can't cover them. That's a problem. And April Ryan was part of this whole thing, would say, well, you can't tape me because somebody else might use my image in this form or that form. If you're a journalist, you can't do that.
We have to set that. We have to grant other people the same level of access we would want
absolutely.
For ourselves.
Absolutely. I mean, you can't do that.
Okay. Well, that music means we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our Links blog. That's under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next time, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our theme music. I'm Amy Simons. We'll be with you again next time for more Views of the News.